Chapter 4, Are Flying Saucers Real? I went to the Pentagon the next morning. I didn't expect to learn much, but I wanted to make sure we weren't tangling with security. I'd worked with Al Shalin and Orville Split, in the magazine section of public relations, and I thought they'd tell me as much as anyone. When I walked in, I sprang it on them cold. What's the chance of seeing your Project Saucer files? Al Shalin took it more or less deadpan. Split looked at me a moment and then grinned. Don't tell me you believe the things are real? Maybe, I said. How about clearing me with Project Saucer? Al shook his head. It's still classified secret. Look, Don, said Split, why do you want to fool with that saucer business? There's nothing to it. That's a big change from what the Air Force was saying. In 1947, I told him. He shrugged that off. The Air Force has spent 2 years checking into it. Everybody from Symington down will tell you the saucers are bunk. That's not what Project Saucer says in that April report. That report was made up a long time ago, said Split. They just got around to releasing it. Then they've got all the answers now? They know there's nothing to it, Split repeated. In that case, I said, Project Saucer shouldn't object to my seeing their files and pictures. What pictures? That one taken at Harmon Field, Newfoundland, for a starter. Oh, that thing, said Split. It wasn't anything, just a shadow on the cloud. Somebody's been kidding you. If it's just a cloud shadow, why can't I see it? Split was getting a little nettled. Look, you know how long it takes to declassify stuff. They just haven't got around to it. Take my word for it, the flying saucers are bunk. I went around with Sid Shalit on some of his interviews. What he's got in the post is the absolute gospel. It's funny about that April 27th report, I said, the way it contradicts the post. I tell you that was an old report, I wouldn't say that, Al Shalin put in. The Air Force doesn't claim it has all the answers. But they've proved a lot of the reports were hoaxes or mistakes. Just the same, I said, the Air Force is on record, as of April 27th, that it's serious enough for everybody to be vigilant. And they admit most of the things, in the important cases, are still unidentified. Including the saucer Mantell was chasing. That business at Godman Field was some kind of hallucination, insisted Split. I suppose all those pilots and Godman Field officers were hypnotized? Not to mention several thousand people at Madisonville and Fort Knox? Take it easy, you guys, said Al Shalin. You've both got a right to your opinions. Oh, sure, said Split. He looked at me, with his grin back. I don't care if you think they're men from Mars. Let's not go off the deep end, I said. Tell me this. Did Shalit get to see any secret files at Wright Field? Absolutely not. Then he had to take the Air Force word for everything? Not entirely. We set up some interviews for him. One more thing, and don't get mad. If it's all bunk, why haven't they closed Project Saucer? How do I know? Probably no one wants to take the responsibility. Then somebody high up must not think it's bunk, I said. Split laughed. Have it your own way. Before I left, I told them I was working with True. I want to be on record, I said, as having told you page 32. This. If there's any security involved, if you tell me it's something you're working on, naturally I'll lay off. Al Shalin said emphatically, it's not an Air Force device, if that's what you mean. Some people think it's Russian. If it is, I don't know it, said Al, and neither does the Air Force. After I left the magazine section, I tried several officers I knew. Two of them agreed with Split. The third didn't. I've been told it's all bunk, he said, but you get the feeling they're trying to convince themselves. They act like people near a haunted house. They'll swear it isn't haunted, but they won't go near it. Later, I asked a security major for a copy of the Project Saucer report. We're out of copies right now, he said. I'll send you one next week. I asked him bluntly what he thought the saucers were. I doubt if anybody has the full answer, he said seriously. There's been some hysteria, also a few mistakes. But many reports have been made by reliable pilots, including our own. You can't laugh those off. As I drove home, I thought over what I'd heard. All I had learned was that the Air Force seemed divided. But that could be a smokescreen. In less than 24 hours, I received my first suspicious tip. It was about 10 a.m. when my phone rang. Mr. Kehoe? This is John Steele, said the voice at the other end. Because of the peculiar role he played, then and later, I have not used his real name. I'm a former Air Force intelligence officer. I was in the European theater during the war. I waited. He hesitated a moment. I heard you're working on the flying saucer problem, he said quickly. I may have some information that would interest you. Mind telling me who told you I was on it? I asked. No one, directly. I just happened to hear it mentioned at the press club. Frankly, I've been curious about the flying saucers ever since 45. That startled me, but I didn't tell him so. Do you have any idea what they are? Mr. Steele said. No, I've just begun checking. But I'd be glad to hear what you've got. I may be way off, said Steele. But I've always wondered about the Foo Fighters our pilots saw over Europe near the end of the war. I thought for a second. Wasn't that some kind of anti-aircraft missile fired from the ground? No. Intelligence never did get any real answer, so far as I know. They were some kind of circular gadgets, and they actually chased our planes a number of times. We thought they were something the Nazis had invented, and I still think so. Then who's launching them now? Well, it's obviously either Russia or us. If it is the Soviet, well, that's what's worried me. I don't think it should be treated like a joke, the way some people in the Pentagon take it. I stared at the phone, trying to figure him out. I'd like to talk it over with you, I said. Maybe you've got something. I've given you about all I know, Steele answered. There was an intelligence report you might try to see, the 8th Air Force files should have it. Wait a minute, I said. Give me your number, in case I find anything. He gave it to me without apparent hesitation. I thanked him and hung up, still wondering. If it was an attempt at a plant, it was certainly crude. The mention of his former Air Force connection would be enough to arouse suspicion, unless he counted on his apparent frankness to offset it. And what about the press club angle? That would indicate Steele was a newspaper man. Could this be merely an attempt to pump me, and get a lead on True's investigation? But that would be just as crude as the other idea. Of course, he might be sincere. But regardless of his motives, it looked bad. Arid who had told him about me? I thought about that for a minute. Then I picked up the phone and dialed Jack Daly's number. Jack, do you know anyone named John Steele? I asked him. I think he's a newspaper man. Nobody I know, said Jack. Why, what's up? I explained, and added, I thought maybe you knew him, and he'd heard about it from you. Hell, no, said Jack. You ought to know I wouldn't leak any tip like that. It wouldn't be a tip, I don't know anything about this deal yet. By the way, when you were on the Star did you handle anything on Foo Fighters? No, that was after I left there. Bill Shippen would have covered that, anyway. I told him I would look it up in the Star's morgue. Jack said he would meet me there at 3 o'clock. In the meantime he would see what he could find out about Steele. Jack was a little late, and I went over the Star's file on the Foo Fighters. Most of the facts were covered in a story dated July 6, 1947, which had been inspired by the outbreak of the saucer scare. I copied it for later use. During the latter part of World War II, fighter pilots in England were convinced that Hitler had a new secret weapon. Yanks dubbed these devices Foo Fighters or Kraut Fireballs. One of the Air Force intelligence men now assigned to check on the saucer scare was an officer who investigated statements of military airmen that circular Foo Fighters were seen over Europe, and also on the bombing route to Japan. It was reported that intelligence officers have never obtained satisfactory explanation of reports of flying silver balls and discs over Nazi-occupied Europe in the winter of 1944-45. Later, crews of B-29s on bombing runs to Japan reported seeing somewhat similar objects. In Europe, some Foo Fighters danced just off the Allied fighters' wingtips and played tag with them in power dives. Others appeared in precise formations, and on one occasion a whole bomber crew saw about 15 following at a distance, their strange glow flashing on and off. One Foo Fighter chased Lieutenant Myers of Chicago some 20 miles down the Rhine Valley, at 300 mph, an AP war correspondent reported. Intelligence officers believed at that time that the balls might be radar-controlled objects sent up to foul ignition systems or baffle Allied radar networks. There is no explanation of their appearance here, unless the objects could have been imported for secret tests in this country. I read the last paragraph twice. This looked like a strong lead to the answer, in spite of the Air Force denials. There was another, less pleasant possibility. The Russians could have seized the device and developed it secretly, using Nazi scientists to help them. Perhaps the Nazis had been close to an atomic engine, even if they did fail to produce the bomb. Jack Daly came in while I was reading the story again. I got the dope on Steele, he said. He does pieces for a small syndicate, and I found out he was in the Air Force. I think he was a captain. People who know him say he's okay, a straight shooter. That still wouldn't keep him from giving me a fake tip, if somebody told him it was the right thing to do. Maybe not, said Jack, but why would they want to plant this Foo Fighter idea? I showed him the clipping. He read it over, and shook his head. That's a lot different from discs 300 feet in diameter. If we got the principle, or Russia did, building big ones might not be too hard. I still can't swallow it, said Jack. These things have been seen all over the world. How could they control them that far away, and be sure they wouldn't crash, where somebody could get a look and dope out the secret? We argued it back and forth without getting anywhere. I'd give a lot to know Steele's angle, I said. If you hear anything more on him, give me a buzz. Jack nodded. I'll see what I can do. But I can't dig too hard, or he'll hear about it. On the way out, I found a phone booth and called Split. Foo Fighters, he said. Sure, I remember those stories. You think those are your flying saucers? I could hear him snicker. Just checking angles, I said. Didn't the 8th Air Force investigate the Foo Fighters? Yes, and they found nothing to back up the pilot's yarns. Just war nerves, apparently. How about a look at the intelligence report? I asked. Wait a minute. Split was gone for twice that time, then he carned back. Sorry, it's classified. If all this stuff is bunk, why keep the lid on it? I demanded. I was getting sore again. Look, Don, said Split, I don't make the rules. Sure, I know, sorry, I said. I had a notion to ask him if he knew John Steele, but hung up instead. There was no use in banging my head against the Air Force wall. The next day I decided to analyze the Mantell case from beginning to end. It looked like the key to one angle. The question of an Air Force secret missile. Unless there was some slip-up, so that Mantell and his pilots had been ordered to chase the disc by mistake, then it would be cold murder. I couldn't believe any Air Force officer would give such an order, no matter how tremendous the secret to be hidden. But I was going to find out, if possible. Chapter 5. For more than 2 weeks, I checked on the Godman Field tragedy. One fact stood out at the start. The death of Mantell had had a profound effect on many in the Air Force. A dozen times I was told. I thought the saucers were a joke until Mantell was killed chasing that thing at Fort Knox. Many ranking officers who had laughed at the saucer scare stopped scoffing. One of these was General Sory Smith, now Deputy Director of Air Force Public Relations. Later in my investigation, General Smith told me, it was the Mantell case that got me. I knew Tommy Mantell very well, also Colonel Hicks, the CO at Godman. I knew they were both intelligent men, not the kind to be imagining things. For 15 months, the Air Force kept a tight-lipped silence. Meantime, rumors began to spread. One report said that Mantell had been shot, his body riddled with bullets. His P-51, also riddled, had simply disintegrated. Another rumor reported Mantell as having been killed by some mysterious force. This same force had also destroyed his fighter. The Air Force, the rumors said, had covered up the truth by telling Mantell's family he had blacked out from lack of oxygen. Checking the last angle, I found that this was the explanation given to Mantell's mother. Just after his death, she was told by Standiford field officers that he had flown too high in chasing the strange object. Shallet, in the Saturday Evening Post articles, described Project Saucer's reconstruction of the case. Mantell was said to have climbed up to 25,000 feet, despite his firm decision to end the chase at 20,000, since he carried no oxygen. Around 25,000 feet, Shallet quoted the Air Force investigators, Mantell must have lost consciousness. After this, his pilotless plane climbed on up to some 30,000 feet, then dived. Between 20,000 and 10,000 feet, Shallet suggested, the P-51 began to disintegrate, obviously from excessive speed. The gleaming object that hypnotized Mantell into this fatal climb was, Shallet said, either the planet Venus or a Navy cosmic ray research balloon. The Air Force Project Saucer report of April 27, 1949, released just after the first Post article, makes these statements. 5 minutes after Mantell disappeared from his formation, the two remaining planes returned to Godman. A few minutes later, one resumed the search, covering territory 100 miles to the south as high as 33,000 feet, but found nothing. Subsequent investigation revealed that Mantell had probably blacked out at 20,000 feet from lack of oxygen, and had died of suffocation before the crash. The mysterious object which the flyer chased to his death was first identified as the planet Venus. However, further probing showed the elevation and azimuth readings of Venus, and the object at specified time intervals did not coincide. It is still considered unidentified. The Venus explanation, even though now denied, puzzled me. It was plain that the Air Force had seriously considered offering it as the answer, then abandoned it. Apparently someone had got his signals mixed and let Shallet use the discarded answer. And for some unknown reason, the Air Force had found it imperative to deny the Venus story at once. In these first weeks of checking, I had run onto the Venus explanation in other cases. Several Air Force officers repeated it so quickly that it had the sound of a stock alibi. But in the daytime cases, this was almost ridiculous. I knew of a few instances in World War II, when bomber crews and anti-aircraft gunners had loosed a few bursts at Venus. But this was mostly at night, when the planet was at peak brilliance. And more than one gunner later admitted firing, to relieve long hours of boredom. Since enemy planes did not carry lights, there was no authentic case, to my knowledge, where plane or ground gunners actually believed Venus was an enemy aircraft. Page 39. Checking the astronomer's report, I read over the concluding statement. It simply could not have been Venus. They must have been desperate, even to suggest it in the first place. Months later, in a secret Project Saucer report released December 30, 1949, I found official confirmation of this astronomer's opinions. Since it has a peculiar bearing on the Mantell case, I am quoting it now. When Venus is at its greatest brilliance, it is possible to see it during daytime, when one knows exactly where to look. But on January 7, 1948, Venus was less than half as bright as its peak brilliance. However, under exceptionally good atmospheric conditions, and with the eye shielded from direct rays of the sun, Venus might be seen as an exceedingly tiny bright point of light. However, the chances of looking at just the right spot are very few. It has been unofficially reported that the object was a Navy cosmic ray research balloon. If this can be established, it is to be preferred as an explanation. However, if one accepts the assumption that reports from various other localities refer to the same object, any such device must have been a good many miles high, 25 to 50, in order to have been seen clearly, almost simultaneously, from places 175 miles apart. If all reports were of a single object, in the knowledge of this investigator, no man-made object could have been large enough, and far enough away for the approximate simultaneous sightings. It is most unlikely, however, that so many separated persons should at that time have chanced on Venus in the daylight sky. It seems therefore much more probable that more than one object was involved. The sighting might have included two or more balloons, or aircraft, or they might have included Venus and balloons. For reasons given above, the latter explanation seems more likely. Two things stand out in his report. 1. The obvious determination to fit some explanation, no matter how far-fetched, to the Mantell sighting. 2. The impossibility that Venus, a tiny point of light, seen only with difficulty, was the tremendous metallic object described by Mantell, and seen by Godman field officers. With Venus eliminated, I went to work on the balloon theory. Since I had been a balloon pilot, before learning to fly planes, this was fairly familiar ground. Shallet's alternate theory that Mantell had chased a Navy research balloon was widely repeated by readers unfamiliar with balloon operation. Few thought to check the speeds, heights, and distances involved. Cosmic ray research balloons are not powered. They are set free to drift with the wind. This particular Navy type is released at a base near Minneapolis. The gas bag is filled with only a small percent of its helium capacity before the takeoff. In a routine flight, the balloon ascends rapidly to a very high altitude, as high as 100,000 feet. By this time the gas bag has swelled to full size, about 000 feet high and 70 feet in diameter. At a set time, a device releases the case of instruments under the balloon. The instruments descend by parachute, and the balloon, rising quickly, explodes from the sudden expansion. Occasionally a balloon starts leaking, and it then remains relatively low. At first glance, this might seem the answer to the Kentucky sightings. If the balloon were low enough, it would loom up as a large circular object, as seen from directly below. Some witnesses might estimate its diameter as 250 feet or more, instead of its actual 70 feet. But this failure to recognize a balloon would require incredibly poor vision on the part of trained observers, state police, army MPs, the Godman field officers, Mantell and his pilots. Captain Mantell was a wartime pilot, with over 3,000 hours in the air. He was trained to identify a distant enemy plane in a split second. His vision was perfect, and so was that of his pilots. In broad daylight they could not fail to recognize a balloon during their 30-minute chase. Colonel Hicks and the other Godman officers watched the object with high-powered glasses for long periods. It is incredible that they would not identify it as a balloon. Before its appearance over Godman Field, the leaking balloon would have drifted, at a low altitude, over several hundred miles. A leak large enough, to bring it down from high altitude would have caused it to land and be found. Drifting at a low altitude, it would have been seen by several hundred thousand people, at the very least. Many would have reported it as a balloon. But even if this angle is ignored, it still could not possibly have been a balloon at low altitude. The fast flight from Madisonville, the abrupt stop and hour-long hovering at Godman Field, the quick bursts of speed Mantell reported make it impossible to fly the go miles from Madisonville to Fort Knox in 30 minutes. A balloon would require a wind of 180 mph. After traveling at this hurricane speed, it would then have had to come to a dead stop above Godman Field. As the P-51s approached, it would have had to speed tip again to 180, then to more than 360, to keep ahead of Mantell. The three fighter pilots chased the mysterious object for half an hour. I have several times chased balloons with a plane, overtaking them in seconds. In a straight chase, Mantell would have been closing in at 360. The tailwind acting on his fighter would nullify the balloon's forward drift. But even if you accept these improbable factors, there is one final fact that nullifies the balloon explanation. The strange object had disappeared when Mantell's wingman searched the sky just after the leader's death. If it had been a balloon held stationary for an hour at a high altitude, and glowing brightly enough to be seen through clouds, it would have remained visible in the same general position. Seen from 33,000 feet, it would have been even brighter, because of the clearer air. But the mysterious object had completely vanished in those few minutes. A search covering 100 miles failed to reveal a trace. Whether at a high or low altitude, a balloon could not have escaped the pilot's eyes. It would also have continued to be seen at Godman Field and other points, through occasional breaks in the clouds. I pointed out these facts to one Air Force officer at the Pentagon. Next day he phoned me. I figured it out. The timing device went off and the balloon exploded. That's why the pilot didn't see it. It's an odd coincidence, I said, that it exploded in those 5 minutes after Mantell's last report. Even so, it's obviously the answer, he said. Checking on this angle, I found 1. No one in the Kentucky area had reported a descending parachute. 2. No cosmic ray research instrument case or parachute was found in the area. 3. No instruments were returned to the Navy from this region. And all balloons and instruments released at that time were fully accounted for. Even if it had been a balloon, it would not explain the later January 7th reports, the simultaneous sightings mentioned by Professor Hynek in the Project Saucer report. This includes the thing seen at Lockbourne Air Force Base 2 hours after Mantell's death. Obviously, the saucer seen flying at 500 mph over Lockbourne Field could not have been a balloon. Even if there had been several balloons in this area, and there were not, by official record, they could not have covered the courses reported. In some cases, they would have been flying against the wind, at terrific speed. Then what was the mysterious object? And what killed Mantell? Both the Air Force and the Post articles speculate that Mantell carelessly let himself black out. Since some explanation had to be given, this might seem a good answer. But Mantell was known for cool-headed judgment. As a wartime pilot, he was familiar with signs of anoxia, oxygen starvation. That he knew his tolerance for altitude is proved by his firmly declared intention to abandon the chase at 20,000 feet, since he had no oxygen equipment. Mantell had his altimeter to warn him. From experience, he would recognize the first vague blurring, narrowing of vision, and other signs of anoxia. Despite this, the blackout explanation was accepted as plausible by many Americans. While investigating the Mantell case, I talked with several pilots and aeronautical engineers. Several questioned that a P-51 starting a dive from 20,000 feet would have disintegrated so thoroughly. From 30,000 feet, yes, said one engineer. If the idea was to explain it away, I'd pick a high altitude to start from. But a pilotless plane doesn't necessarily dive, as you know. It might slip off and spin, or spiral down, and a few have even landed themselves. Also, if the plane started down from 20,000, the pilot wouldn't be too far blacked out. The odds are he'd come to when he got into thicker air, admitting he did blur out, which is only an Air Force guess. I don't see why they're so positive Mantell died before he hit the ground, unless they know something we don't. One of the pilot group put it more bluntly. It looks like a cover-up to me. I think Mantell did just what he said he would, close in on the thing. I think he either collided with it, or more likely they knocked him out of the air. They'd think he was trying to bring them down, barging in like that. Even if you accept the blackout answer, it still does not explain what Mantell was chasing. It is possible that, excited by the huge, mysterious object, he recklessly climbed beyond the danger level, though such an act was completely at odds with his character. But the identity of the thing remains, officially, a mystery. If it was some weird experimental craft or a guided missile, then whose was it? Air Force officers had repeatedly told me they had no such device. General Carl Towie Spots, former Air Force chief, had publicly insisted that no such weapon had been developed in his regime. Secretary Symington and General Hoyt Vandenberg, present Air Force chief, had been equally emphatic. Of course, official denials could be expected if it were a top-level secret. But if it were a secret device, would it be tested so publicly that thousands would see it? If it were an Air Force device, then I could see only one answer for the Godman Field incident. The thing was such a closely guarded secret that even Colonel Hicks hadn't known. That would mean that most or all Air Force base COs were also in ignorance of the secret device. Could it be a Navy experiment, kept secret from the Air Force? I did a little checking. Admiral Calvin Bolster, chief of Aeronautics Research Experimental Craft, was an Annapolis classmate of mine. So was Captain Delmer S. Farney, head of the Navy Guided Missile Program. Farney was at Point Mugu, Missile Testing Base in California, and I wasn't able to see him. But I knew him as a careful, conscientious officer. I can't believe he would let such a device, piloted or not, hover over an Air Force base with no warning to its CO. I saw Admiral Bolster. His denial seemed genuine. Unless he'd got to be a deadpan poker player since our earlier days, I was sure he was telling the truth. The only other alternate was Russia. It was incredible that they would develop such a device, and then expose it to the gaze of U.S. Air Force officers. It could be photographed, its speed and maneuverability checked. It might crash, or anti-aircraft fire might bring it down. The secret might be lost in one such test flight. There was one other explanation. The thing was not intended to be seen. It had got out of control. In this event, the long hovering period at Godman Field was caused by the need for repairs inside the flying saucer, or repairs to remote control apparatus. If it were Air Force or Navy, that would explain official concern. Even if completely free of negligence, the service responsible would be blamed for Mantell's death. If it were Russian, the Air Force would of course try to conceal the fact for fear of public hysteria. But if the device was American, it meant that Project Saucer was a cover-up unit. While pretending to investigate, it would actually hush up reports, make false explanations, and safeguard the secret in every possible way. Also, the reported order for Air Force pilots to pursue the disks would have to be a fake. Instead, there would be a secret order telling them to avoid strange objects in the sky. By the time I finished my checkup, I was sure of one thing. This particular saucer had been real. I was almost positive of one other point, that the thing had been over 30 miles high during part of its flight. I found that after Mantell's death it was reported simultaneously from Madisonville, Elizabethtown, and Lexington, over a distance of 175 miles. Professor Hynek's analysis later confirmed this. How low it had been while hovering over Godman, and during Mantell's chase, there was no way to determine. But all the evidence pointed to a swift ascent after Mantell's last report. Had Mantell told Godman Tower more than the Air Force admitted? I went back to the Pentagon and asked for a full transcript of the flight leader's radio messages. I got a quick turndown. The reports, I was told, were still classified a secret. Requests for pictures of the P-51 wreckage and for a report on the condition of Mantell's body also drew a blank. I had heard that some photographs were taken of the Godman field saucer from outside the tower. But the Air Force denied knowledge of any such pictures. Puzzling over the riddle, I remembered John Steele, the former intelligence captain. If by any chance he was a plant, it would be interesting to suggest the various answers and watch his reaction. When I phoned him to suggest luncheon, Steele accepted at once. We met at the Occidental, on Pennsylvania Avenue. Steele was younger than I had expected, not over 25. He was a tall man, with a crew haircut and the build of a football player. Looking at him the first time, I expected a certain breeziness. Instead, he was almost solemn. "I owe you an apology," he said in a careful voice after we'd ordered. "You probably know I'm a syndicate writer?" I wondered if he'd found out Jack Daly was checking on him. "When you mentioned the press club," I said, "I gathered you were in the business. I'm afraid you thought I was fishing for a lead." Steele looked at me earnestly. "I'm not working on the story, I'm tied up on other stuff." "Forget it," I told him. He seemed anxious to reassure me. I'd been worried for some time about the saucers. "I called you that night on an impulse." "Glad you did," I said. "I need every tip I can get. Did it help you any?" "Yes, though it still doesn't fit together. But I can tell you this. The saucers are real, or at least one of them." "Which one?" "The thing Captain Mantell was chasing near Fort Knox, before he died." "Oh, that one." Steele looked down at the roll he was buttering. I thought that case was fully explained. "Wasn't he chasing a balloon?" "The Air Force says it's still unidentified." I told him what I had learned. "Apparently you're right, it's either an American or a Soviet missile." "After what you've told me," said Steele, "I can't believe it's ours. It must be Russian. They'd be pretty stupid to test it over here. You said it was probably out of control. That particular one, maybe. But there have been several hundred seen over here. If they found their controls were haywire, they wouldn't keep testing the things until they'd corrected that." The waiter came with the soup, and Steele was silent until he left. "I still can't believe it's our weapon," he said slowly. "They wouldn't have Air Force pilots alerted to chase the things. And I happen to how they do." "There's something queer about this missile angle," I said. "That saucer was seen at the same time by people 175 miles apart. To be that high in the sky, and still look more than 250 feet in diameter, it must have been enormous." Steele didn't answer for a moment. "Obviously, that was an illusion," he finally answered. "I'd discount those estimates. Even Mantell's? And the Godman field officers? Not knowing the thing's height, how could they judge accurately? To be seen at points that far apart, it had to be over 30 miles high," I told him. "It would have to be huge to show up at all." He shook his head. "I can't believe those reports are right. It must have been sighted at different times." I let it drop. "What are you working on now?" Steele asked, after a minute or two. I said I hadn't decided. "Actually, I planned a trip to the coast, to interview pilots who had sighted flying discs." "What would you do, if you found it wasn't a Soviet missile?" said Steele. He sounded almost too casual. "If security was involved, I'd keep still. But the Air Force and the Navy swear they haven't any such things. Steele looked at me thoughtfully. You know, Drew might force something into the open that would be better left secret. He smiled ironically. I realize that sounds peculiar, since I suggested the Russian angle. But if it isn't Russian, though I still think it is, then we have nothing to worry about. I was almost sure now that he was a plant. During the rest of the luncheon, I tried to draw him out, but Steele was through talking. When we parted, he gave me a sober warning. You and Drew should consider your moral responsibility, no matter what you find. Even if it's not actual security, there may be reasons to keep still. After he left me, I tried to figure it out. If the Air Force was back of this, they must not think much of my intelligence. Or else they had been in such a hurry to get a line on Drew's investigation that they had no choice but to use Steele. Of course, it was still possible he was doing this on his own. Either way, his purpose was obvious. He hoped to have us swallow the Soviet missile answer. If we did, then we would have to keep still, even though we found absolute proof. Obviously, it would be dangerous to print that story. Thinking back, I recalled Steele's apparent attempt to dismiss the Mantell case. I was convinced now. The Godman Field affair must hold an important clue that I had overlooked. It might even be the key to the whole flying saucer riddle. Chapter 6. Shortly after my talk with Steele, I flew to the coast. For 3 weeks I investigated sightings that had been reported by airline and private pilots and other competent witnesses. At first, the airline pilots were reluctant to talk. Most of them remembered the ridicule that had followed published accounts by other airline men. One pilot told me he had been ordered to keep still about his experience, whether by the company or the Air Force, he would not say. But most of them finally agreed to talk if I kept their names out of print. One airline captain, I'll call him Blake, had encountered a saucer at night. He and his copilot had sighted the object, gleaming in the moonlight, half a mile to their left. We were at about 12,000 feet, he said, when we saw this thing pacing us. It didn't have any running lights, but we could see the moonlight reflecting from something like bright metal. There was a glow along the side, like some kind of light, or exhaust. Could you make out the shape? I asked. Blake grinned crookedly. You think we didn't try? I cut in toward it. It turned in the same direction. I pulled up about 300 feet, and it did the same. Finally, I opened my throttles and cut in fast, intending to pull tip if we got too close. I needn't have worried. The thing let out a burst of reddish flame and streaked up out of sight. It was gone in a few seconds. Then it must have been piloted, I said. If not, it had some kind of radar responder unit to make it veer off when anything got near it. It matched every move I made, until the last one. I asked him what he thought the saucer was. Blake hesitated, then he gave me a slow grin. Well, my copilot thinks it was a spaceship. He says no pilot here on Earth could take that many G's when the thing zoomed. I'd heard some men from Mars' opinions about the saucers, but this was an experienced pilot. You don't believe that? I said. No, Blake said. I figure it was some new type of guided missile. If it took as many G's as Chuck, my copilot, thinks, then it must have been on a beam and remote controlled. Later, I found two other pilots who had the same idea as Chuck. One captain was afraid the flying saucers were Russian. His copilot thought they were Air Force or Navy. I met one airline official who was indignant about testing such missiles near the airways. Even if they do have some device to make them veer off, he said, I think it's a risk. There'll be hell to pay if one ever hits an airliner. They've been flying around for 2 years, a line pilot pointed out. Nobody's had a close call yet. I don't think there's much danger. When I left the coast, I flew to New York. Ken Purdy called in John Dewberry, Drew's aviation editor, to hear the details. Purdy called him John the Skeptic. After I told him what I had learned, Purdy nodded. What do you think the saucers are? Asked Dewberry. They must be guided missiles, I said, but it leaves some queer gaps in the picture. I had made up a list of possible answers, and I read it to them. 1. The saucers don't exist. They're caused by mistakes, hysteria, and so on. 2. They're Russian guided missiles. 3. They're American guided missiles. 4. The whole thing is a hoax, a psychological warfare trick. You mean a trick of ours? Said Purdy. Sure, to make the Soviets think we could reach them with a guided missile. But I don't think that's the answer, I just listed it as a possibility. Dewberry considered this thoughtfully. In the first place, you'd have to bring thousands of people into the scheme, so the discs would be reported often enough to get publicity. You'd have to have some kind of device, maybe something launched from high-flying bombers, to give the rumors substance. They'd certainly do a better job than this, to put it over. And it wouldn't explain the worldwide sightings. Also, Captain Mantell wouldn't kill himself, just to carry out an official hoax. John's right, said Purdy. Anyway, it's too ponderous. It would leak like a sieve, and the dumbest Soviet agent would see through it. He looked back at my list. Cross off number 1, there's too much competent testimony, beside the obvious fact that something's being covered up. That leaves Russian or American missiles, I said, as Steele first suggested. But there are some points that just won't fit the missile theory. You've left out one answer, said Purdy. What's that? Interplanetary. You're kidding, I said. I didn't say I believed it, said Purdy. I just say it's possible. Dewberry was watching me. I know how you feel. That's how it hit me, when Ken first said it. I've heard it before, I said. But I never took it seriously. Maybe this will interest you, Purdy said. He gave me a note from Sam Bull. Just talked with D, the note ran. D is a prominent aeronautical engineer, the designer of a world-famous plane. He believes the discs may be interplanetary, and that the Air Force knows it, or at least suspects it. I'm enclosing sketches showing how he thinks the discs operate. He's not the first one who told us that, said Purdy. We've heard the same thing from other engineers. Over a dozen airline pilots think they're coining from out in space. And there's a rocket expert at Wright Field who's warned Project Saucer that the things are interplanetary. That's why I'm not writing it off. Have you read the Project Saucer ideas on space travel? Dewberry asked me. I told him my copy hadn't reached me. He read me some marked paragraphs in his copy of the preliminary report. There has been speculation that the aerial phenomena might actually be some form of penetration from another planet. The existence of intelligent life on Mars is not impossible, but is completely unproven. The possibility of intelligent life on the planet Venus is not considered completely unreasonable by astronomers. Scientists concede that living organisms might develop in chemical environments which are strange to us. In the next 50 years we will almost certainly start exploring space. The chance of space travelers existing at planets attached to neighboring stars is very much greater than the chance of space traveling Martians. The one can be viewed as almost a certainty. Dewberry handed me the report. Here, I practically know it by heart. Take it with you. You can send it back later. I know the space travel idea sounds silly at first, said Purdy, but it's the only answer that explains all the sightings, especially those in the last century. He asked Dewberry to give me their file of historic reports. While John was getting it, Purdy went on. Be careful about this man, Steele. After what he said about moral responsibility, I'm sure he's planted. I thought back to Steele's warning. I told Purdy. If he had the space thing in mind, maybe he's right. It could set off a panic that would make that Orson Welles thing look like a picnic. Certainly it could, Purdy said. We'd have to handle it carefully if it turned out to be the truth. But I think the Air Force is making a mistake, if that's what they're hiding. It could break the wrong way and be serious. John Dewberry came back with a file of old reports. It might interest you to know, he said, that the Air Force checked all these old sightings too. The idea was still a difficult one for me to believe. Those space travel suggestions might be a trick, I said. The Air Force may be hinting at that to hide the guided missile secret. Yes, but later on they deny the space thing, said Purdy. It looks as if they're trying to put people on guard, and then play it down, so they won't get scared. As I put the historic reports file in my briefcase, Purdy handed me a letter from an investigator named Hilton, who had been working in the Southwest. I skimmed over his letter. Hilton had heard of some unusual night sightings in New Mexico. The story had been hushed up, but he had learned some details from a pilot at Albuquerque. One of these mysterious flying lights had been seen at Las Vegas on December 8, 1948, just 1 month before Mantell was killed in Kentucky. It was too dark to make out the shape behind the light, but all witnesses had agreed on its performance. The thing had climbed at tremendous speed, its upward motion shown by a bright green light. Though the green glow was much brighter than a plane's running light, all plane schedules were carefully checked. I think they were trying to pin it on the jet fighter, the Albuquerque pilot told Hilton. But there weren't any jets near there. Anyway, the thing climbed too fast. It must have been making close to 900 miles an hour. The Air Force had also checked balloon release times, apparently just for the record, since no balloon could even approach the saucer's terrific ascent. Again, they drew a blank. From the way this was hushed up, Hilton commented, they seem to be worried about this group of sightings. I've heard two reports that the FBI is tied into the deal somehow, but that's as far as I can get. See if you can get any lead on that, Purdy told me. That FBI business puzzles me. Where would they come in? I said I would try to find out. But it was almost 4 months before we learned the answer. The FBI men had been witnesses. This was later admitted in an obscure cross-reference in the final Project Saucer report. But all official answers to the strange green light sightings had been carefully omitted. The cases concerned were 223, 224, 225, 226, 227, 230, and 231, which will be discussed later. When you go back to Washington, said Purdy, see what reaction you get to the interplanetary idea. I had a pretty good idea what the reaction would be, but I nodded. Okay. I'll go flag a spaceship and be on my way. Okay, gag it up, said Purdy. But don't sell it short. If by any chance it's true, it'll be the biggest story since the birth of Christ. End of episode 2, Are Flying Saucers Real?